So in the first part of this lecture, I told you a little bit about string theory, its basics, and what it tells us about the real world, supersymmetry, extra dimensions, all this stuff, that all the string states should be corresponding to particles in our world. But I didn't really tell you, of course, about the equations of string theory, how we really do string theory, and what we understand and what we don't understand on the theoretical level. So, why isn't this finished business? Why didn't we calculate everything through and say whether it was okay or whether it was not okay? It seems to be too arbitrary at the moment, string theory. Now, the problem is the following. That string theory is perturbative by definition. It means that actually the only thing we know about string theory are these tube diagrams. So we only know about how to calculate Feynman diagrams of strings. Now, so what does this mean in practice? So we look at the equations, and then the equations that string theory gives us, and then what we do is we fix the space-time background. So we choose, for example, flat space. And we do this in a consistent way. We check that actually flat space is consistent, that we can actually put this into our string theory equations. And then we consider the propagation of string states on this space-time, on this stage that we fixed. And so this involves then the setting up of these diagrams, these tube diagrams. Now, there's a parameter, the string coupling, which is actually in some sense part of the stage. We fix it before we actually do our calculations. So we fix the string coupling to be something small, because we want to do a perturbative expansion. This has to be consistent, of course, with all the equations, but we know, we can check this. And then we actually can calculate these diagrams by using this value for the string coupling. Now, if we're interested in environments where gravity is large, like, for example, what we would really like to solve, of course, using string theory, is things like black hole physics, the Big Bang, singularity, those things, the situations that involve large gravity. Now, in fact, roughly speaking, strong string coupling corresponds to strong gravitational environments. So whenever you're interested in a black hole, let's say you want to discuss strings in the background of a black hole spacetime, it turns out that the string coupling becomes large at some point. And when the string coupling becomes large, this sum, which is basically a consecutive approximation of the specific amplitude that you're interested in, is no longer a good approximation scheme, because the second diagram will be bigger than the first diagram or of the same order. So you cannot really approximate the answer by summing up over all these diagrams. So in other words, we don't really understand string theory in strong gravitational environments, because we cannot do the calculations. And this is, of course, where string theory should really be describing what's going on in these strong gravitational environments, so the Big Bang or the black holes. So many interesting questions we would like to answer involve strong string coupling at some point, and this is when all our equations break down. So we have no control whatsoever. And for instance, this is when we want to consider the Big Bang, black holes, etc. So the basic question, what is string theory, is really not solved. We don't know what string theory really is. Because to really know what string theory is, you need to know what happens in these, under these conditions that you have strong gravitational fields. Now, so over the last 10 years, so this will get more advanced as we move on, because I want to tell you a little bit about the exciting developments that took place over the last 10 years. Because over the last 10 years, we found out a lot of things about non-perturbative strings. So what I mean with this is about string theory at strong coupling. So in environments that involve strong gravitational fields or these things. So how do we know about that? So first of all, remember that, maybe it was on the previous slide, yes. Quantum field theory, although we use these diagrams to do calculations in quantum field theory, although they're then not tubes, but point-like diagrams, just the ordinary Feynman diagrams, quantum field theory is at least defined non-perturbatively. So what do I mean with that? We have our equations, and they are valid for all values of the coupling, how these particles interact. These equations are valid for all values of the coupling. It's just that getting answers out of this theory, we typically use a perturbative expansion, and this perturbative expansion is only valid for weak coupling. But we do have some information about non-perturbative physics and quantum field theory because it is defined for all values of the coupling. Now, this is not true for strings, but we can make use of the correspondence principle, which is basically saying that low-energy superstrings can approximately be described by quantum field theories. However, this is a special kind of quantum field theory. It's a supersymmetric theory because we're dealing with superstrings, and it involves classical gravity as well. So that's why we call it supergravity. So when we look at the string, and we look at it from a very, very far away, the string looks very tiny, and to a good approximation, you can actually use ordinary quantum field theory or classical gravity to describe some circumstances. And the corrections to these descriptions will be measured by basically the string length, right? There are some corrections, but typically we don't even have to consider those. So in these supergravity theories, so you can now analyze, basically what we're analyzing is classical gravity with some sources that are basically given to you by supersymmetry. So there are some charges around, electrical charges, magnetic charges, and stuff like that. And in these theories, there exist what are called classical soliton solutions, which are basically, if you think about ordinary GR, we know that there are solutions in DR, in general relativity, that correspond to black holes, right? Black holes have masses, could have masses, but they could also have other kinds of charges, electric charges, magnetic charges. Now, these supergravity theories, this is basically these soliton solutions that are called black P brains are basically extensions, generalizations of that. So, why are they called brains? Because you can actually consider, in some sense, extended objects, solutions. So, a black hole is basically a dot, and then there is some space-time structures surrounding it. But you can also consider, actually, in those theories, you can actually consider strings that are basically surrounded by some curved space-time. And they are called black strings. So this is where the charge and mass sits. And this is possible because you have charge on these lines. So they can actually support this line, these objects. They can be supported on this line. Now you can actually go on. You can actually consider membranes, right, that give rise to a particular curved space-time structure. And they exist in all kinds of extended dimensions. And that's why they're called brains. So P stands for the extension of the object. So P is 1 is a string. P is 2 is a membrane, etc., etc. Now, so how you should think about this is that they're just extensions of ordinary black hole solutions. They extend it also in their spatial extendedness. And they have electrical charges and masses. Now, so that's what I was trying to say here. They're very special in the following sense, that they carry a mass and a charge. Now, if you know that masses always attract each other, but charges tend to expel each other, right? So we can set up, actually, solutions where the mass and charge ratio is just right, such that there is no force between two of these objects, right? Because the electromagnetic attraction, or the gravitational attraction, is exactly cancelled by the electromagnetic repulsion. And those are the things that actually have all kinds of special properties. If you choose this mass and charge ratio just the right way. And most surprisingly, one of the biggest discoveries over the last years, that these solutions have a special interpretation in string theory. So, as I told you, we started from string theory, we looked at long distances, then we could use these so-called supergravity theories. They have these funny things in their spectrum. There are these p-brains, black p-brains in their spectrum. Now, consequently, turning the argument around, these objects should also exist in the string theory. So instead of all these states, the little oscillation, the oscillations of the string, the excited states of the string, string theory should also have a place for these black p-brains. They should somehow exist in the string theory as well. And in fact, it was discovered that these things correspond to so-called d-brains. And d-brains are basically surfaces on which open strings can end. So, let me also draw it for you on the blackboard a little bit, maybe to make it a little bit more intuitive. So initially string theory, for example, if you looked at a closed string theory, only looked at the states that existed on this single string. So there's a graviton, there's all this other stuff. But now it turns out that you actually add basically a surface in string theory as well, and consider open strings with their endpoints attached to this surface. This is a mathematical procedure that's consistent. And you can also consider how these open strings, so when they, for example, interact on the surface, they can actually combine to form a closed string. And actually, closed strings can actually bounce on this surface and separate into two open strings. So closed strings and open strings interact on this surface. And in fact, you can do the calculation in string theory. The surface has a mass, and it has some charge. It has some electric charge or some generalized electric charge. So these objects are now, you can add to string theory. They should be added based on this correspondence. And we have a good description in terms of open strings of these objects. And it turns out that the masses and charges of these objects, so here you see an open string, another open string, and another open string, and they combine to send off a closed string, graviton, for example. And it turns out that the masses and charges of this surface, corresponding to the surface, actually completely agree with the masses and charges of these classical soliton solutions. So they are one and the same thing. So this is basically the map. So over here, you have basically a gravity solution. So there is some, over here in the bottom, there is some mass, there is some charge. And the space-time actually curves up because of the mass of this object. And on the other hand, we have a description in string theory. So this is a description in the supergravity theory. On the other hand, you have a description in terms of open strings, where basically there's a surface, and open strings interact with closed strings, etc., etc. Now, one of these, one such an object in string theory, can actually, you can add another one because of this no force condition. So the charges and masses of these objects are just right to be able to put more of them together. So you can add more and more of them. And although one of them is very light and cannot be very accurately described by using this gravitational picture, if you add more and more of them, the space around such an object will curve and become like this. So from a microscopic, so in the end, the picture is as follows. In string theory, consider string theory in flat space. You can actually introduce these objects. They have some mass, they have some charge. However, they're light. Their mass is not so big, and it does not give rise to a lot of bending of space-time. You can actually add this to flat space-time. But now you can add more and more of them, because actually there's no force between these things. So you add more and more of them, they become heavier and heavier and heavier, and at some point they give rise to this picture. where you have basically a curved space-time picture. And these two things, they match. Now, why is this non-perturbative? Well, it turns out that this object is a non-perturbative object in the sense that at weak string coupling, this object is very large, is very heavy, in a sense. It's very heavy. So it means that it's not included in perturbative calculations, because in perturbative calculations, you only take into account the light states, essentially. However, if the string coupling becomes large, these objects become dominant. These are the most important objects, in a sense, in the string theory, if the string coupling becomes large. So it can give this object give you some information about non-perturbative string theory. Now, so I'll leave this subject behind for a little bit. It should be in the back of your mind. So you have these strange objects called D-brains in string theory. And now I want to tell you a little bit about black hole physics. So forget about string theory for a while. And just think about black holes. Now, we all know that when an object's mass is localized within the Schwarzschild radius, it should be considered a black hole. Now, for all for typical situations, elementary particles, for example, the uncertainty in a position of an elementary particle is always bigger than the Schwarzschild radius, so an elementary particle cannot be considered a black hole because its uncertainty is always bigger than its Schwarzschild radius. However, when Planck scale energies are involved, then actually the uncertainty in the position of the particle at some point becomes equal to the Schwarzschild radius. And it seems that actually black holes should also be considered in the context of Planck scale scattering, for example, Planck scale scattering of elementary particles. Now, an important property of black holes is actually that they have mass, charge, and they can rotate, but that's it. So they have no other properties. So this is, if you think about it, this is a little bit strange, because a black hole can be basically made, if you think about the black hole being formed in our universe, it's formed from a lot of stuff that has all kinds of detailed properties, like, there are electrons and photons, and they all fall into the black hole, and they have a lot of there's a lot of information stored in all these properties, and what you end up with is a black hole that only has mass, charge, and a rotation. So two different black holes on different sides of the universe that have the same, that are formed in a completely different way, but have masses and charges and rotation that are the same, cannot be distinguished. They're formed in very different ways, but these are all the properties that they have. And when these are equal, you cannot distinguish two of those black holes, even though they are formed in very different ways. Now, so this is sometimes said as black holes have no hair. It's a little bit strange, isn't it? But anyway, this is what is sometimes, this is what is mostly used to express this idea. Now, I spotted the black hole there. Right. anyway. And these are classical properties, in a sense. And of course, the major discovery by Hawking was that actually black holes, they're not entirely black. Black holes emit Hawking radiation. And they do this in such a way that the spectrum that you see, if you would be far away from a black hole, and you would detect all the stuff that's coming out of the black hole, that the spectrum of this radiation is actually thermal. So you can actually associate a thermodynamical temperature and entropy, because whenever you have temperature, you also have entropy. You can associate the thermodynamical temperature and entropy to the black hole. You see, the Hawking radiation is basically the effect that particles and antiparticles can no longer annihilate. And because the vacuum is actually filled with particle pairs that quickly get produced and then annihilate, some of them will actually are no longer able to annihilate because one of them enters the event horizon. So that's how you can actually end up with real particles. And actually the spectrum or the energy spectrum is actually such that it's perfectly thermal. this spectrum. Now, so you can actually associate this thermodynamical temperature and entropy, but we don't have a statistical, mechanical, microscopic interpretation of this. So typically, in all the situations that we really understand, you start from a statistical, mechanical description, so you know the microscopic properties responsible for the thermodynamical observables. You can actually calculate probabilities, etc., etc. However, in this case, you cannot, because actually we don't really know what the statistical mechanical interpretation is of this temperature. So here I actually shown you some equations. For example, this is an equation for a black hole. If you change the mass of the black hole, then you can actually relate that to the change of area in the event horizon. So for a black hole has a mass and it has an event horizon. When you throw something in to increase the mass, the event horizon, of course, will also increase. And this is the relation between these two quantities, the area of the event horizon and the mass of the black hole. And you should compare it to this equation in thermodynamics, which says that when you actually increase the energy of something, of a thermodynamical object, then this is actually proportional to the temperature times the change in entropy. This is basically a law of, this is just a law of thermodynamics, and they look very similar. And because the energy, of course, energy is nothing but mass following Einstein, there's actually a tendency to associate, and actually what Hawking did was actually show this explicitly, to associate the change in area with the change in entropy, and to associate this factor in front with the temperature. And this is what happens then, is actually you get exactly the right temperature to describe Hawking radiation. So the temperature of a black hole is actually proportional to 1 over Newton's constant times the mass of the black hole. And the entropy of a black hole is actually proportional to the area of the black hole. So this just follows from the basic observation that Hawking made, that black holes radiate this radiation is populated in a thermal way. Okay, but we certainly do not have an understanding of what the microscopic degrees of freedom are responsible for this, of the black hole responsible for this temperature and entropy. So let's think about strings and black holes. Now, there are special charged black holes. So if I just told you that black holes can have a mass, but they can also have a charge. Now, then they already look very similar to these P-brains that I showed you that exist in string theory. Now, special charged black holes, they can be modeled in string theory using these D-brains that I just explained to you. The special properties of these black holes, because they have charges that actually cancel the gravitational attraction, allows one to follow its behavior as we lower the string coupling. Now, as I said, strong string coupling is basically associated with strong gravitational environments. Because a black hole is a strong gravitational environment, this means that this is really a strong string coupling phenomenon. But because of these special properties, which is basically a consequence of supersymmetry, really, you can actually follow the behavior of these black holes if you just take the string coupling and lower it. And in fact, at weak coupling, one can count the open string degrees of freedom on the D-brains. So you can actually look at these D-brains, which are surfaces with these open strings on it, and you can count the string degrees of freedom on these D-brains, these open string degrees of freedom. And remarkably, this is really a remarkable result, this reproduces the black hole entropy. The entropy of a black hole is basically telling you how many degrees of freedom there are in the black hole. And you can actually, what string theory can do in some cases, is reproduce this number for you. Now, maybe I actually didn't tell you that. Maybe we should go back a little bit. Ah, I didn't tell you that, apparently. So, one major problem with this picture is that, see, I you can tell here, this is actually a picture I downloaded from Gerrit het Hooft, a Nobel Prize, Dutch Nobel Prize winner. I downloaded it from his website. So what you can see is that there are chairs are thrown into the black hole, and thermal stuff comes out. Now, the problem here is the following. We know exactly, if you think about it in terms of quantum mechanics, you know exactly the quantum state of the chair that you throw in. So you throw in the black hole, you know exactly, you follow its evolution. Quantum mechanics is what they call, unitary, that's what they call it. It means that you actually can follow its evolution and everything is determined afterwards. So there's no problem with following the evolution. You follow the evolution of this quantum state, it goes into the black hole, and what comes out is only thermal radiation. So it's only the Hawking radiation that comes out, and it seems to have no relationship whatsoever with what you've thrown in, the chairs. So you cannot actually follow the state from the chair to the Hawking radiation. There seems to be no connection. And this is called the information loss paradox. And this is how Hawking thought about black holes, that basically it would be a breakdown of quantum mechanics, because you can actually not, quantum mechanics does not fully apply here, because you cannot follow the evolution from the chair into the Hawking particles. So this was called the information loss problem. However, it turns out that in string theory, if you follow the procedure that I just did, so you start with the black hole, and it radiates these Hawking modes, and you now take the string coupling, and you tune it to become very small, then this black hole will actually look like this surface with these open strings on it, and these open strings can actually form closed strings that move off the brain, and that would correspond to these Hawking modes. Now in this picture, there's no problem whatsoever with information loss. You can follow the states of an incoming closed string, turning into an open string, and then flying off as a closed string again. So it turns out that in string theory, in this deep brain picture, there is no information loss problem. And basically what string theory is suggesting is that the information loss problem is just an artifact. It means that you're not carefully enough looking at the different modes in this process. If you would be careful enough, you could really focus on all the details of this process. It's like when you burn, when you have a fire. Of course, the fire gives off heat and radiation, and it's all thermally distributed. And we know, of course, that ultimately this is because the particles, the stuff that the wood is made of is reacting with oxygen, and we can in principle follow this procedure in all detail, but typically, of course, we don't. Right? This is a very hard calculation to do. But we have an understanding of what the microscopics is of this process, and there's certainly no information loss when you burn a fire, when you have a fire in your home. So indeed, you should actually compare a black hole in the same sense. If you look at the microscopics very carefully, there is no information loss. It's just an artifact of looking at this process in a very bad way. Now, so now I'm coming in really into the hard stuff and the conceptual ideas that we are now thinking about in string theory. It's called the holographic principle, and it's tied to the black hole situation that I've just shown you. Now, so in the absence of gravity, thermodynamical systems have an entropy that scales with the volume. Extensively, that's what we call it. It scales extensively. What do we mean with that? Well, if you have a system in a box, and it has some number of degrees of freedom, and you increase, so the entropy is actually proportional of the stuff in this box. If you grow the volume, you can actually allow for more degrees of freedom in this box, right? And the entropy actually scales with the volume of the box, right? There's actually a minimum amount of volume that you can associate to 1 degree of freedom. So the total entropy scales with the volume. This is what we mean that entropy scales extensively. In the presence of gravity, this is no longer true. The reason being that if you add more and more energy into a finite volume, let's say you have a finite box, at some point, a black hole, a black hole will be formed, and we know that the black hole, actually, if you're, that's what I should have told you, I guess, over here, this is actually saying that the black hole carries an entropy of 1 degree of freedom per Planck area. So it's actually distributed over the surface of this Schwarzschild surface as 1 degree of freedom per Planck area. So, this is the wrong direction. So if a black hole is formed and you increase the energy in your box, then we know that actually at some point there's actually going to be 1 degree of freedom per Planck area. So it seems to be that at some point entropy scales with the area instead of with the volume. And this led to the conjecture, actually at Hooft was the first one to make this conjecture, that quantum gravity is what they call a holographic theory, in the sense that the fundamental degrees of freedom live in one dimension less and reproduce our world holographically. A hologram is basically nothing but three-dimensional information on a two-dimensional surface. And this is in some sense similar, because this two-dimensional information on the surface encodes all the physics in our three-dimensional world. For a black hole, this is certainly the case. Now, the question is, it's all very nice. It's almost philosophical. And when this was first published, I don't think there were many people very enthusiastic about this, although it was a nice idea. But the question, of course, is, can we find calculable examples? And in particular, is string theory holographic? So there's been a major progress in this direction, and it again involves these brains. Now, this is a little bit complicated, but please bear with me. If you get lost, please ask me to explain better. This is what I'm here for. Consider these D brains again. So they have basically two descriptions. On the one hand, they have a geometrical space-time description, where you look at the curved space surrounding this object. And on the other hand, you have an open string description. So a description in terms of open strings stuck to the surface, interacting. Now, what you can do, in fact, on both sides of this description, you can take what is called a low energy limit. You can take some limit, and it has to do with taking a low energy limit. And what happens in that case is that you take the geometry of this brain, this P brain, you take this geometry. So this is basically the geometry of this brain. And typically a geometry is very curved close to the brain. But of course, when you go further and further away from it, actually space will become flat. So this is Minkowski space. So this is a picture of the geometry. It's a very bad picture of the geometry, but anyway, it's all I can give you. And so what happens if you take this low energy limit is you're going to focus on this region of the geometry. So in this limit, what happens is that you actually reduce this curved space due to this brain to this region. And this region, in fact, in all cases that we know, is an anti-de Sitter space. It's called the space-time is shaped in exactly the right way to be called anti-de Sitter. Now, what is anti-de Sitter? It's relatively simple. I told you last week about a positive cosmological constant and how it would actually curve space and lead to accelerating expansion. Anti-de Sitter, and that was actually a de Sitter space. Anti-de Sitter is actually the space-time you get when you consider a negative cosmological constant. So when you take the equations of general relativity, plug in a negative cosmological constant, you get anti-de Sitter space. So this is the reason we'll focus on taking this limit. And in fact, you can take the same limit in this open string description of this object. And what happens then, open strings actually carry the among the massless states is the Gates boson, is a Gates boson. So what happens in this case is that the open string theory actually reduces to Gates theory. So a point particle theory, QCD, a supersymmetric extension of QCD in a way. And in the end, of course, these two descriptions should actually describe the same physics. And that's where the this is an important point. Because this led to what is now called the ADS-CFT correspondence, which implies the following. That string theory on this ADS spacetime can equivalently be described by a Gates theory in one dimension less. So why is it one dimension less? So think of this, the source of this curved space is this brain, which is basically sitting here. Essentially, and then the extra direction in which the space is curved is moving away from the brain. So, if you now focus on this little region, then this direction up here, is away from the brain. But you actually consider the physics on this anti de Sitter space, which therefore has one extra dimension, which has one more dimension than the physics of this this Gates theory on this brain. So string theory on ADS on this ADS spacetime has one dimension more. This is this physics in one dimension more than the physics described by this Gates theory. So in other words, if you say that these descriptions should be equal, then this Gates theory that's living on this brain is able to describe bulk gravitational physics in one extra dimension. This is really surprising. And it's called, and it's really holographic. So you have this Gates theory that somehow knows about gravity. Because there's actually, it should describe the same physics as string theory on this ADS spacetime. Now this has led to really a rather, well, almost a revolution, I would say, in thinking about string theory. Because this also led to relationships between string theory and QCD. And the basic question in QCD that still is unanswered is why do we never see quarks? So the qualitative answer we know, because it's basically saying that the QCD coupling becomes stronger as the distance between quarks increases. So the field lines squeeze, and it becomes actually more it's easier then for the field lines to create an extra pair of quarks, right, than to actually snap apart and give rise to two free quarks. So quarks always come in pairs, and we have a qualitative understanding of why this is so, because the interactions become strong as you increase the distance. However, we have no quantitative control. QCD is perfectly well-defined theory, and we should, in principle, be able to calculate, for example, hadron masses, Mason masses, all the stuff we see around us. But we can't, because these hadron masses and Mason masses are actually properties of the theory that should be deduced from strongly coupled effects. And we don't have control over these effects. In fact, this property of QCD, that you never see free quarks, was the historical reason for string theory. So it was not first introduced because people wanted to describe gravity, but because of the fact that this looks very much like a string. So if you look at, so the field lines are squeezed between these quarks, so this object looks very much like a string, and this was the first time string theory was actually introduced. Now, however, the stuff that I told you about on the previous slide actually is a very different picture of how QCD and string theory, the way we understand it now, are related. Because basically what it tells you is that string theory on ADS space, which is basically closed string theory on ADS space, is related to a supersymmetric version of QCD. So you have this supersymmetric version of QCD, which sits on this brain, and then you have closed string theory in this ADS spacetime, which actually should describe exactly the same physics. And in fact, this is use now to learn about strongly coupled QCD using string theory or gravity, essentially. So this is, and actually there are some results, and people are very hopeful that maybe in some time we can actually calculate hadron masses and stuff like that using basically gravity. This will actually, the guy who does it will actually win a big prize, because there's like $1 million of money for it. If you can solve this problem, you'll win a lot of money, actually. So this is one thing that we now use string theory for as well. So I hope it's a hard job, but I hope I've given you some idea of some of the surprising developments in string theory. And one other thing that I would like to mention is how in string theory we think about space-time, because it's a little bit different. So what string theory really tells us about quantum space-time. I already told you that when you have compact dimensions, particles can actually move in these compact dimensions, and there are extra states which are proportional to one over the radius of this compact dimension. However, of course, if you have strings, there's another thing you can do. You can actually wrap the compact dimension. So a string, because it is an extended object, can wrap around the compact dimensions. This is, a particle cannot do this, but a string can. So it means that there are two kinds of states in the non-compact dimensions. So think again about this two-dimensional universe, and you add this extra circle. And now you have strings that actually move around the circle, but you also have strings that wrap around the circle. So you have two kinds of states. You have on the one hand these Kaluza-Klein momentum modes that I already told you about, whose mass is proportional to basically the number of times it fits on this compact dimensions times 1 over r. That's the mass of the state. And then there are what are called winding modes. So a string can actually wind around the compact dimension. And of course, the energy of such a winding string is actually proportional to r. So it's n times the number of times the string is wound around the compact manifold times the radius over the string scale, string length squared. So here you see an example. So this is a string that's not wrapped around the compact dimension, and it can move around only in discrete ways because of the wave-like nature. And this is a string that's actually wrapped around once, and this is a string that's wrapped around twice. Now, the thing is that an observer will not be able to distinguish these states, because they are not distinguishable in any way. So whether something is a Kaluza-Klein mode or a winding mode, it's really you cannot tell the difference. These states look the same in every other way. So this also means that the radius of compact dimension is ambiguous, because the winding mode is proportional to r, the Kaluza-Klein momentum mode is proportional to 1 over r, these states are indistinguishable, so the radius is actually, you cannot tell the radius of the compact dimension with certainty, because what is small, if you say it's a winding mode, then actually the radius is probably, if it's a winding mode, then you say that the radius is relatively small, whereas if you say the same state is a momentum mode, Kaluza-Klein momentum mode, the radius is very big. So this seems to suggest the following. In other words, basically there's a symmetry. So if you take r in this object and replace it by ls squared over r, you actually interchange these two formulas, right? So large radius from the winding mode point of view is small radius from the momentum, Kaluza-Klein momentum mode point of view, and vice versa. So strings apparently see space-time very differently. And in fact, you could say that space-time is a derived concept in string theory. So it's not something that you start out with, it's something that comes out. And in fact, you could also say that the string length corresponds to a minimal length. Why? For example, if you plug in that the radius is ls, then there is basically symmetry between these modes. So if you say that the radius is ls, then the mass of the winding mode is 1 over ls, and the mass of the Kaluza-Klein momentum mode is also 1 over ls. So this is kind of a minimal radius. So it seems that strings see space-time very differently, and this is just one example of it. I mean, there are many others. I mean, you can look at what is called mirror symmetry. There are basically all kinds of situation where actually the space-time that you consider looks differently depending on what probe you use. So, and this is an important point. So this is basically all I want to say about stringy space-time. We still have to face, this is also one of the revolutions took place over the last 10 years, we still have to face the important issue that we actually have 5 consistent superstring theories, which is really an embarrassment of riches, of course, because, well, you would like to have only one. And the idea is that, again, because of these D-brains that I just introduced, the D-brains are very fundamental in the increase in our understanding over the last 10 years, in fact. It turns out that by using certain techniques, that all 5 string theories are related through non-perturbative dualities. It means non-perturbative, meaning that you cannot see it at weak string coupling. You only see it when you consider strong string coupling. So these are relations between seemingly very different theories. And how did we find these things? Well, again, we looked at the low energy theory, so supergravity in particular, and we focused on the states that are in these theories, again, these D-brains, and then you map the different states found in the different string theories, and it turns out that there are connections. So here's a picture of the situation before we actually discovered that these things, well, and after, before and after the fact that we discovered that these things are related. So in our community, there were people who always worked on type 2B string theory, and they did all kinds of perturbative, so small string coupling calculations, and they never knew about the other ones. So there were also some people that worked on type 2A string theory. There were some people that worked on type 1, heterotic, and heterotic E. And all these people, they were just working independently in a way. And what we found out is actually that by increasing your horizon a little bit, it turns out that all these people are working on the same theory, but in different corners of the theory, in a sense. And in fact, I think this whole, so all these theories are related by non-perturbative, what are called dualities. And in fact, it also includes, which is very strange, an 11-dimensional strongly coupled theory, which is provisionally called N-theory for no good reason, and whose low energy limit is 11-dimensional supergravity. So this is the this is in some sense very interesting, because in the supergravity community, which I probably should have drawn somewhere around here, there were some people working on only supergravities. They found out that the highest dimension in which you can actually construct a supergravity theory is 11. And they thought this should mean something, but they didn't really know what it should mean. But it turns out that in this by discovering all these relationships, there's also a relationship to this 11-dimensional supergravity theory, although we don't know what the microscopic description is. We think that membranes should play an important role, and the reason is the following picture. It turns out that if you look at one of these string theories, type 2A, and you consider the fundamental strings that exist in this theory, and you go to strong coupling, turns out that these strings, they grow an extra internal dimension. So this is basically the idea. So this is the string in 10 dimensions. However, there's actually a small internal dimension as well. So that basically the string unfolds to become a membrane if you grow one extra dimension. So this is basically the picture that we've come up with. It's basically, if you take a membrane in 11 dimensions, wrap it around a circle, it looks like a string, and it looks exactly like the type 2A string. Of course, if you do this, you increase the coupling, so you lose all calculational control. If you turn this string into a membrane, you basically don't have control over what happens when you scatter these membranes, for example. Anyway, this is a very beautiful picture. It seems to be consistent, and it's also fully unified, because now we have a unique theory. All these different string theories are secretly related, and they give rise to a unique structure somehow, although I have to admit we don't understand this structure very well. We don't understand the fundamental microscopic structure very well. We only know that there are all kinds of relationships. Now, I'm almost done actually. So, now I'm back at my favorite topic. So, I like to think about strings and cosmology a little bit. Now, this is a very tough job. Actually, there's now a growing number of people working on this issue because of recent observations. So these cosmological issues have been brought back to the foreground because of the detection of a cosmological constant, inflation, and these things. And of course, the questions we want to solve are basically the singularity problem with the Big Bang. We also would like to find cosmological what are called cosmological vacua, because over the last 30 years, string theorists have been very busy trying to reproduce the standard model, but it has always been the standard model on flat space. So we've only worried about particle physics on flat space. And of course, our four-dimensional world is really a four-dimensional universe, and the universe is curved, so we should really reproduce our universe instead of just the flat sections. So we should worry about finding cosmological vacua. In particular, we should worry about finding states in string theory that can give rise to accelerating expansion. So the one that we seem to observe seems to be preferred. So in that context, accelerating expansion is actually effectively described by what is called a de Sitter space, which is basically the opposite of anti-de Sitter space that I have been discussing. So de Sitter space is a space-time where the source is a positive cosmological constant. And that's what the Sitter space is. And the issues surrounding the Sitter space are essentially very similar to the issues that surround black hole physics. The reason being that the Sitter space also has a temperature, because you're surrounded in the Sitter space by an event horizon, and you see thermal quanta coming in your direction. So the Sitter space has a temperature, and it also has an entropy. However, we don't understand the microscopic reason for this temperature entropy. And we made a lot of progress in the context of black holes, but not for the Sitter space. So this is really an interesting issue to try to understand using string theory. There has been some progress, but it's only very, very small, I would say. The issue is that this is very complicated because of the time dependence of the background. Cosmology is all about time dependence of space-time. And this is something string theory is very bad at. It's very hard to deal with time dependence in string theory. And also, again, typically, we are entering a strong coupling regime. This picture is actually a little artist's impression of how you would create a universe in a laboratory. But, well, don't take it too seriously. So, some remarks here, that inflation, which is actually something that seems to be preferred by observations. The CMB, the cosmic microwave background, tells you that probably there had to be a phase of primordial accelerating expansion called inflation. And this can effectively be described by a de Sitter phase in the primordial universe. And what I just said, basically that it can be considered, the Sitter space can be considered the cosmological equivalent of a black hole. And therefore, it's very important that we should try to understand the Sitter space in string theory. Also note that anti-de Sitter and de Sitter spacetime, I discussed anti-de Sitter in this lecture for the D-brain case, are almost the same. From a mathematical point of view, they're very similar spacetimes. So maybe some of the things that we've learned about anti-de Sitter spacetime can be applied to the Sitter spacetime. So this gives some hope that now is a good time to address cosmological issues. But again, progress is very, very slow so far. Or I am very slow. So let me end by giving you a small summary. Now, I've been very conceptual and maybe somewhat vague in this talk, but I wanted to give you an idea of what string theory is and convey to you that string theory is a very rich, extremely exciting, and attractive theoretical structure. Which seems very promising in solving some long-standing mysteries, such as black hole physics, quantum space-time, strongly coupled QCD, and more even. And in fact, I did not mention the huge impact string theory has in other areas like mathematics and condensed matter theory. So it's really a very, very, very rich structure. Now, clearly, much remains to be done. And from a formal point of view, we have to face up to the very basic question, what is string theory? Or, taking into account all the dualities, the relations between these string theories, what is end theory? We really don't know. And another problem, which is really huge, the biggest problem from a physicist's point of view, stepping down from the formal situation, is that at the moment, string theory does not make a single falsifiable prediction. So the theoretical structure is extremely nice, it's very appealing, but we don't have a single prediction that string theory makes at the moment that can be tested in such a way that you can exclude string theory if you don't find it. So this is not, the LHC might find supersymmetry, it might find extra dimensions, but it will not tell you that string theory is right. So this is a problem that we should face up to. I think it's, in my personal opinion, this can only, probably we should really think about cosmology a lot harder, which is the only observational chance I see in the future to shed light on this issue. Anyway, so let me also give you some useful links, because I think there's a lot of things you can find on the internet. I would say I would highly recommend the popular science books by Brian Greene, The Elegant Universe, and now there's his latest book, The Fabric of the Cosmos, which is very nice. I just read it. Actually, Brian has its own website, or basically the PBS. PBS has its own website where, because in the States they had a documentary on string theory. I'll come back to the slides in a minute if you're taking notes. They had a documentary with Brian Greene as the major star, which is, you can find on the web, and there's all kinds of useful information. There's actually a teacher's guide here. And actually, I wanted to see if we can see the preview, because this is overdoing it a little bit, in my opinion, but it's kind of nice to watch. Let's see. It's essentially propaganda, but anyway. It's really cool. It's too bad we probably can we turn on the sound? I don't know. Well, we'll see how it goes. Do you see anything? I don't see anything. Let's try this. Yes. Ah. So now we should turn the sound up, but that's Brian. Yeah, they did a very good job. It's a man of Pete. Science and mathematics, or the alternate theory of everything. Good question. Glashow, this is Sheldon Glashow. This is Gates, I think. Okay, so it's that's my it's a little propaganda. let me first go back to the. Let's see. You can also buy his books here, I think. I'm not sure, but you can go to Amazon. Okay, so that's that's this link. Probably very useful. There's also the so-called official Superstring website, where there's a lot of information. There are other interesting websites, in fact. So there's one, I'm just promoting a colleague of mine here, that has a nice website, actually hosted in Belgium. And then, well, I did some lectures in Michigan on string theory, and they can be found at my homepage. So there's probably a lot more on the internet, and you can do your own little searching. So that's all I want to say today. If you have any questions, just let me know. Thanks. No questions? Well, I went a little fast, I guess, but... oh, sorry, you're writing it down, right? Okay. Oh, these transparencies will also be on the web, yes. Yeah, this too, yes. It includes this. So, yeah, you can do... you can find everything back on the web at some point. Okay, so enjoy your last week, I guess, and have fun. Thanks for your attention.